is October 27th, 2011. This is the Hermetic Hour with your host, Poke Runyon, and tonight we present a discussion of Halloween. Well, from the Hermetic perspective, actually, this is more of a pagan holiday, but we all, we Hermetics, are pagans, as well as being biblical. So we celebrate anything we want, and our sister lodge, Feriferia, has had, of course, and I hope still does have, a Samhain ceremony, which we'll briefly cover. And since they departed for Northern California, we've developed a Samhain rite of our own, evoking Mote, the original Grim Reaper himself. And we will also recall the 1974 and 1975 Tom Snyder Halloween special that aired on the old NBC Tomorrow show. And that show featured Fred Adams and Ed Fitch and Isaac Bonowitz, who's just passed away recently, and your host, and which we aired Feriferian and OTA rites, filmed by the distinguished pagan filmmaker Joe Carson, who will call in later tonight. I'll mention my strange adventure atop the Pyramid of the Sun in Mexico on the Day of the Dead in 1988, and we'll give a preview of this year's Dark Mother of All Halloween Parties, coming soon to a national forest near you, that is, if you live in Southern California. So tune in and get trick-or-treated. Okay, so first, you know, let's kind of get a historical perspective on Halloween, and for that we turn to our friendly resource, Wikipedia, and they say that the historian Nicholas Rogers, exploring the origins of Halloween, notes that while some folklorists depicted its origin in the Roman Feast of Pomona, the goddess of fruits and seeds, or in the Festival of the Dead called Parentalia, it is more typically linked to the Celtic Festival of Samhain, whose original spelling was S-A-M-U-I-N, pronounced Samhain or Samhain. The name of the festival, historically kept by the Gaels and the Celts in the British Isles, is derived from Old Irish and means roughly summer's end. According to the Oxford Dictionary of English Folklore, certainly Samhain was a time for festive gatherings in medieval Irish texts, and later Irish, Welsh, and Scottish folklore use it as a setting for supernatural encounters, but there is no evidence that it was connected with the dead in pre-Christian times or that pagan religious ceremonies were held. Now, this could indicate, if you want to be kind of skeptical, this could indicate that after the Christians established All Saints Day, which follows Halloween, of course, that's All Hallows Eve, this could indicate that maybe we have here a very early Dark Age pagan rebellion against it. It's okay, if the Christians want to have All Saints Day and honor the dead, then we pagans will the night before really, really honor. That's quite possible, because it is ever since early medieval times, or as far as back probably Dark Ages, it's been associated with that. And it's universal all over the world. I said that I would mention my experience on the Pyramid of the Sun in Mexico on the Day of the Dead in 1988. And so I will, because that gives you an idea of how universal this has gotten to, this think it's gotten to be. Now, Shelton Applegate, I know, Joe, I don't know, you remember Shelley, and Shelton Applegate is kind of an Indiana Jones type. You know, he had me on a couple of National Geographic expeditions down there, and I wouldn't have gotten him on them except for Shelley. So some of the other graduate students at Northridge were really, really jealous of me because I had this buddy who was a professor at the University of Mexico who would get me on these things. But anyway, we were down there in 1988 and in Mexico City going through the Anthropological Museum and on the Day of the Dead. And, oh, boy, the most evil thing I have ever seen in my life. And if you didn't... if you weren't a believer in Lovecraft, this would make you a believer in Lovecraft, is that huge basalt statue of Cuitlicue, the Dark Mother, that they have in the Anthropological Museum. I stood up under that, and I looked up at it, and I told Shelton, I said, Shelley, I said, this is the most evil thing I have ever seen in my life. And he said, they loved her. Oh, boy. Well, anyway, so we went and climbed the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan. Now, that, when you climb up there, the steps are purposefully a little bit too high for the average person to comfortably climb. So by the time you get to the top of that pyramid, and of course it's huge, you get to the top of that thing, you are absolutely exhausted because your legs, you're lifting your legs higher each time you step, and it's and Shelton said, you know, he's an authority. He said, well, they did it that way because it wasn't that they were any taller than we were; it's that they were actually a little shorter. But they did it that way because they wanted the sacrifices to be totally exhausted by the time they got to the top, so they wouldn't have to struggle with them too much to rip their hearts out and feed their hearts to the sun. Well, that's kind of a comforting thought. Well, we get to the top, and the top is flat. It's truncated, and kind of reminds me of a Nokian pyramid. It's just truncated up there, and there's about a 50-foot square area on the top, which is all crowded with the tourists who had managed to stagger to the top. And over in one corner, there was a little huddle of obviously, middle-class urban Mexican kids, you know, and in their 20s. And they were all kind of huddled around in this little group. And I noticed that they didn't want to be seen. They weren't trying to attract attention. In fact, they were trying to kind of be as secretive as they could. And just standing out there in the middle of the day on the top of the Pyramid of the Sun with all these people around them. But then I noticed that monarch butterflies were coming up out of this huddle. And I got over there, and I you know, without pushing them apart or anything, and I really kind of craned and looked around, and I realized they were releasing live monarch butterflies from mason jars. And they really didn't want anybody. They weren't trying to put on an act or anything like that. They were doing this themselves. And I turned around to Shelton, and I said, Shelton, I said, are you seeing this? And he said, yeah. Uh-huh. I said, well, paganism is alive and well in Mexico. Because, of course, the monarch butterfly is the symbol of the soul rising from the dead body. So if you notice, so that we posted one of our icons, Tipperith, on our website a little while back, and you notice that we have that butterfly symbolism rising from the top of the pyramid in that icon. And that, and while I'm on that subject, you might mention that the resurgence of paganism in Mexico was the subject of a novel, a very, very provocative novel by D.H. Lawrence called The Feathered Serpent. That was back in the late 30s, I think he published that. But this is the idea that paganism was still there in Native America and ready to surface again. And so this reverence for the dead is and the Day of the Dead. And of course, as you know, in Mexico they celebrate the Day of the Dead with candy skulls, and their attitude toward the dead is a little healthier in a way than ours. I'm not saying now that I'm not trying to excuse Aztec bloodlust or anything like that. I'm just saying that I think the Mexican attitude toward honoring the dead is perhaps a little better than ours. When people die in America, we have a kind of ritual, like we want to, we honor them in state and all of that, and then we want to bury them, and we want to kind of, we don't want to have them around after that. We go out and visit the cemetery, but we don't want to have them close by. We don't want to bring Grandma and Grandpa back on a particular day. We don't want to do that. And yet, in a lot of places in the world, they do. There are places in the world where the dead are, the ancestral dead, and family dead are buried right in the house or under the house or whatever. And then, conversely, there are cultures where the dead, even of your family dead, are feared, and you want to get rid of them as quick as possible. Just fearful of the dead, the ghosts of the dead. And one of those areas is Mongolia. Once somebody's dead in Mongolia, they want him as far away from the Gur as they can get him, and take him out and dump him out on a hill and let the wolves eat him. But if he's dead, then get him away. But this idea of honoring the dead in most cultures, they do, and of course they do in Mongolia too, but they just, the idea of the body, the ghost, they are afraid of. So we have, and have had ever since, as far back as we can trace in archaeology, we've had a love-hate fear relationship with our dead. So what has happened with whether Samhain ever, it was originally before Christianity, whether Samhain really was a ceremony for honor, it certainly has become one. And Farfaria, as most of you know, Farfaria was the premier goddess-oriented, nature-oriented, neo-pagan organization in the United States, and it's I don't think any organization of its type has ever superseded it as far as elegance and beauty and all that's concerned. Of course, that's my personal, my personal prejudice or whatever. But Farfaria, one of the nine royal passions of Farfaria was Samhain, and November 1st, and I'll read Fred's little description of it here. The festival of sinking to the soil and prophecy. The divine lovers make all life snug for the long winter sleep as seeds and litter settle to the earth. Dreams and all souls rise from the dense rooted underground to soften and fuse them. In the fairy twilight of the year, the dread doors open between the worlds and swing open. The shining lovers descend to their bedchamber of living loam. Ever we go, all right? Yeah, that's nice. And if you have our booklet, our associate members, of course, all have it. Or at least if they don't, they better send for it. You have our booklet, Nine Royal Passions of the Year. You will see a very beautiful icon of Samhain in here, which I'm turning to right now. And this shows the lovers, and it even has a jack-o'-lantern. Fred even had a nice jack-o'-lantern in here. And it's one of these beautiful tarot card kind of images for each one of the nine cross quarter and quarter and cross quarter ceremonies. which are applicable, by the way, very applicable to Wicca. And, you know, they're along with Hermetic magic, they're very applicable to Wicca. So they're sort of universal, pagan, goddess-oriented nature ceremonies. So I'm right now, I am, and I want to have, Joe, if you're out there listening, give us a call in, because I want you to, you know, to tell us about your take on this and while we're talking about Ferroviaria. So this is a portfolio of sacred art, 9 Royal Passions of the Year by Frederick Adams, visionary icons of the seasonal festivals, uniting humankind with nature's eternal cycle of renewal. And we have copies of this, and it's just really beautiful. And like what I like to do is every seasonal, you know, during the period, I like to have one of these icons or tarot card like icons displayed, you know, so I'm sort of in the spirit of the season. Now, what I'd like to talk about here is the Halloween honoring of the dead ceremony that we came up with, and I feel that, you know, we're justified doing that in the Hermetic tradition. We do the solstices and the equinoxes, and we base them, ours, on the ceremonies of ancient Canaan, most of you are aware, and these are based upon the tablets that were discovered at Ugarit back in the late 1930s and finally became translated and available in the 1950s. Joe, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Hi, Polk.
Oh, yeah, good. So, I've just been discussing the Ferroviarian Samhain ceremony, would you like to talk with us a little bit about that?
Sure. As it happens, I was just looking at the Samhain that we filmed back in, like, 1973, I believe it was. I have it up on my desktop right now. And I was reminded of how beautiful it was. We did it in that canyon, in Millard Canyon. And it was fall. All the leaves were turning colors. Svetlana had her beautiful golden robes on and did that lovely dance, sort of going down into the leaves. And leading people through the mottled light. It was beautiful. There was also the homage, you might say, ritually to the secret ceremonies of Eleusis, wearing the kikion on the head and carrying the bits of grain and the sacred waters with the barley. So it was partially that and partially Persephone going into the underworld. There were a lot of layers to that ritual.
Well, you know, part of that, what you're describing, those scenes were aired on the Tom Snyder Halloween show, 1974-1975, and you of course provided the film, both of OTA rituals and the Ferroviarian rituals, and as I recall, because I vividly recall those particular scenes you're describing. Now, we're going to be discussing the Tom Snyder show, and I want you to stay on with us, and we'll be discussing the Tom Snyder show and your contribution to it. Now, I want to mention right now that the 1974-1975 Tom Snyder Halloween show was a very, very pro-neo-pagan effort. I was really, you know, we were really fortunate that we had Tom Snyder and his crew didn't present us in an exploited way. They just did a beautiful job, and your film footage was really the high point of that. Now we will probably make that Tom Snyder show in some way or another, that's going to be made available on the internet. I don't know quite how that's going to happen, but we're going to make that 1 hour classic show available, and then of course that'll really be good. Joe, did you with the Persephone sequence, that was all that And the one with Yuri and his wife, I remember had the candles on her head. Would you kind of give us the origin on that and how that came about?
The candles on her head. You're referring to the winter ceremony, or?
Yes, but yeah, I remember. Well, the two people that did it, they were also OTA members and Perifarian members. She had this bowl on the top of her head with candles around it, and she was standing there, and she had this kind of Fred made the bowl out of paper mache, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a bowl that had these little candle sconces around it. And
well, I'm not sure what you want me to say about them. I'm a little confused. I have a memory of the Kikyon. In fact, I can bring it up here on the screen where I'm looking at it, which has the little bowls which had, like, seeds in them that she wore in the Samhain ritual. Right.
Yeah.
And I don't remember the candles. That's a lovely Swedish tradition, of course. So maybe we should look at this footage together and kind of see
But she had a bowl. She had something on the top of her head. It was kind of a bowl-like thing.
Right, exactly. Right, the Kikyon.
Yeah, see, that was Kikyon. Oh, that was the Kikyon, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, probably the candle thing was, I'm getting that confused with our own Tanit wearing the candles. But now I remember the bowl, and she's standing there, and she's this blonde lady in a white robe.
Yeah,
she's
the blonde lady.
Yeah, the blonde lady.
I'm looking at it now with the black robes, and she's got the Kikyon, which is made out of paper mache with the little individual bowls around the edges of it, which kind of stick up almost in the candle-like fashion.
Yeah.
Which must be what you're imagining, remembering, yeah. And she's wearing her black robes, and she was representing Persephone, who was going to be descending into the underworld and then reappearing.
And Persephone had a mirror, as I recall. She was
when she rose, uh-huh. Yeah, up from the leaves.
Well, do you want to recap for us the quick version of the Persephone aspect of the mythos?
All right. So briefly, Persephone was gathering flowers. Her mother was with her out in the fields, and she was spied by Pluto, who had this insatiable desire for her and whisked her away, is the traditional, mythos. There's many different variations on this. She went into the underworld and was forced to stay there. Her mother was so sad that she was gone that Demeter, who is the mother, the great mother, Demeter, the mother, the great mother, who also is matter, who is earth, she was in grief, and she would not, nothing could grow because she was so sad. Her joy was the growing of plants, and when she was sad, nothing could grow. So the world, none of the gods were being fed. Nobody had any sacrifices that they could make to the gods because nothing was growing. The gods became a little despondent. And so somebody eventually met and made a deal with, I believe, Zeus, which allowed Persephone to come up from the underworld. However, she had stayed there in the underworld for some say 3, some say 6 months, and she had eaten one seed of pomegranate for each month that she was there, and that forced her to repeat that each year. So even though she came up and was reunited with her mother and everything was allowed to grow again, each year she was, because she had eaten these magical pomegranate seeds, she did go back down into the underworld for part of a year each year, and then things did not grow during that time of the year, which created sort of the precedent, the story, the archetypal story for our seasons, for having the winter, the time of no growth, and summer, the time of growth. Interestingly enough, the pomegranate seeds have the highest content of estrogen of any plant, is my understanding. If that's the case, it makes it fascinating to conceive that somehow estrogen, which is obviously related to estrus and female fertility, is so closely linked with the fertility of the land in this story.
Yeah, well, actually, that means that if we really wanted to use proper food symbolism, we should get some pomegranates and have them in our Halloween kind of cornucopia type display that we usually do. You know, they, a lot of people do displays of pumpkins and various foods because along with so I think the pomegranates ought to be part of the symbolism.
Certainly, yeah.
Very and definitely, fake. Yeah.
But you're obviously
yeah.
symbolic.
So now, by the way, while you're on here, I want to mention your film, Gaia Dancing, and remind our listeners that this is a wonderful, wonderful film that Joe did. I think it's a masterwork of neo-pagan and goddess-oriented symbolism, and along with your overseas adventures over there in Europe and visiting the sacred sites and interviewing late, and so you want to mention your website and again give us a little information on how to get that film.
Sure. The film is titled Dancing with Gaia, and the website is gaiadancing.com. And there's a trailer for the film on the website and all kinds of little pieces and blurbs about all the wonderful people that are interviewed in the film who are addressing that meeting point of earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the return of the goddess as Gaia, which is really much, for me, what I feel is the moment. This is the moment that we're at right now where this really is important. It really needs to be brought forward, this intersection, this important joining place where spirit and body connect, the earth energy coming up through us into our bodies, the sacred sexuality, and the awareness of the earth as sacred and the divine nature of the earth and consciousness of the earth. So I think it's terribly important. I think it's terribly exciting, and I hope that people will, you know, at least look at the website and look at the trailer and get a feel for what it's about. The film is available through the website, and it does come with a lovely 48-page color booklet that, you know, goes on at more detail about all the rather powerful techniques that there are in the film for connecting to the earth as part of your larger living body.
Well, that is certainly it's a beautiful film, and I strongly recommend it to everybody listening. It's one of those things that makes you that gets to the heart. It gets to the really to the heart of what the beautiful spiritual aspect of the neo-pagan movement, if we can call it a movement. I think it's more of a the neo-pagan renewal or expression, and I can't recommend it highly enough. Now, what I'd like to do is go over a little bit, go over our particular Samhain ceremony that we've come up with in the last few years and how this came about. As we have a very good, very solid tradition in the OTA and that we've been doing ever since 1974, we've been doing our Canaanite seasonal ceremonies, which are certainly pagan. And one of the Canaanite gods that we really consider to be not really evil, and he's the Grim Reaper, and he's Baal's brother, and he's called Mot or Mot, and spelled M-O-T, and Mot is he's the archetype of the Grim Reaper. He's very sad and gray, and he lives down in what's alternately called the back of beyond or the caverns of beyond the hills and in a kind of a underground swamp kind of a, and he has grasshopper men for guards. These huge grasshopper insect-like creatures, which of course represent the locusts.
All right, we're back on the air, I assume. And let's go back over this this business of our silent ceremony that we do in the OTA. Now we've been doing our seasonal since 1974. I remember Dr. X was in one in 1974. In fact, he played ball in 1974. Now, of course, naturally, our seasonals were influenced by Fred Adams and his Nine Royal Passions of the Year, which we had been doing right along with Farfaria. However, we based ours on the Canaanite cycle from that was dug up in the 1930s at Ugarit in Syria and didn't become available, really. We didn't really know what the ancient Canaanites and Phoenicians were really doing with their religion until the 1950s, 1960s. And so that's the reason why none of the old Victorian magical traditions or Baroque magical traditions had any idea what the Tyrian mysteries were really all about. And that's why we were able to reconstruct these at that time. And now, our god of death in the Canaanite tradition is called Mot. That's M-O-T. And Mot, in the lower grades, in the outer order, so to speak, Mot is evil and menacing, like the Grim Reaper, you know, would be a haunting, menacing figure. But as you get further into the mysteries, you discover that Mot is really not so bad. He comes for everybody, and he's a sad but very wise, and you learn that later on as you go through. But in the seasonal cycle, Mot is he of course slays Baal. You know, he slays the Ur King, and this is where the old Ur King tradition got started. The death of the Ur King, the Green Man, so to speak. That's where it got started, and this is also where the Grail legend got started too. The idea of the blood of the Ur King. And so Mot slays Baal, and then Baal remains in the back of beyond, or down in Mot's underground grotto, until he's resurrected in the fall. Now, Mot is, as I say, the god of death, and he's the Grim Reaper. And just as a little bit of interesting trivia here, those of you who may remember the Mattel's toy series called He-Man, okay, and they made a movie, a rather good movie actually, called Masters of the Universe, and Frank Langella played Skeletor. That did a wonderful job. Now, we had a couple Mattel engineers came to one of our seasonals one time back in the 70s, and they admitted to us that they had used Canaanite mythology to create He-Man and Skeletor, and Tina was actually Anath, and Man-at-Arms was Kusor, and they used Canaanite mythology all the way in. Of course, He-Man was Baal. And Mot was the character Skeletor in both the animated series, of course, and the movie. And yet, as I said, Mot has death. Death in our tradition is not. Terrifying or evil. Death comes to everybody. And so What we do on Halloween is we have a party, and we started this sometime back. We call it the Dark Mother of all Halloween parties. And we have a party, and we have a, you know, a feast and a Bardic Circle and a skit. This time we're going to, we've got several funny skits, but this time the skit's going to be the homunculus of Paracelsus, and we're going to resurrect the homunculus and bring it back to life. You know, that was Paracelsus's alchemical test tube baby that he buried under a mound of horse manure for 41 days and dug up and fed it blood, and supposedly it lived for a while and all. And nobody really knows whether he actually ever did it or not, but it's one of the persistent legends that Paracelsus was able to. So we're gonna have a good time reenacting that dark alchemical experiment. And Dr. X, of course, who is going to be on. We're going to have Dr. X on tonight, but he's tied up with another diabolical experiment he can't lose. But Dr. X will help me. And the theme of the party, of course, is going to be steampunk gothic at Rivendell, of course. But the character of Moat is, of course, central to our silent ceremony. And essentially, what we will do is go out to the henge in a very somber way, and we'll circle the henge in very dim light, have Moat standard in the center. Mass, of course, has the skull on the top and the raven, and we call her Raven nevertheless. And then the horse tail, which Dave Finn donated, and the myrrh incense, of course. You have to have myrrh because that's the incense of Saturn, the incense of death. And then we will evoke Moat. And Moat will appear after being properly evoked and honored. And then he will conduct the remainder of the ceremony. And this is something that, this is a pretty serious thing. And so those of you who attend the Dark Mother of all Halloween parties, be prepared to honor the dead. Now, that's what's coming up, and I want to try to get across the idea here that Halloween represents, in many, many ways, it represents a good. I think healthy respect and veneration for those who have passed on, both in our own families and our own heritage, those who have passed away. We like to think that they're listening, that they return, listen to the tributes we give them, listen to the night that we honor the returning dead. And I don't think there's anything to fear. I think that it reminds us of our mortality, and it reminds us that we would like, when we go, when we've gone, we would like to feel that we are welcome that one night a year back to return and hear somebody remember us. I think we'd like that. I think that's something that we would all appreciate. And so let's not look at Halloween as a time of fear or a time of dread. Let's look at it as a reaffirmation that life goes on, and that we are all immortal. And, of course, in the Hermetic belief, in the Hermetic philosophy, we are. We are all immortal. And so this would be the night that we honor, that we honor our immortality along with honoring our death. And I think that that's important that we realize that. Excuse me. I wonder if Joe, I'm sorry if we cut you off when we didn't cut you off. If you want to call back, please do. I would like to kind of reprise a little bit some of our seasonal cycles relationship to this proposition. Now, as I said, in the summertime in our tradition, this is when Mote, the Lord of Death, comes and kills the Green Man. He kills him in high summer. And the reason why he does it then is because in Southern California and in the Southwest and also in ancient Palestine and in all, high summer was the time of the drought. This was really the time of death. And if the drought was too severe, we didn't recover from it. Hello, Joe, are you back?
Hi, Poke, I'm back.
Oh, good. We had a little glitch there, and so we lost you and me, but we're back now. Anyway, you have any more thoughts on immortality and whatever, because I wanted to sort of get your take on some of my philosophy here.
Well, let's see. I think the OTA has a really awesome program for using the boat imagery for doing the pre. Stop me if I'm revealing too much. Practicing ahead of time for making the journey after death, and getting really good at that, so that when it comes, you're ready. I think that the ritual regalia that you have is about probably the most excellent there is for your Samhain rituals. And the masks are spot on. Philosophically, I'm not sure. I need to be more concrete, or you need to be more concrete. Give me a specific question, and then maybe I could say something sensible.
We're having a revival of Hermetic philosophy that's been going on, and there's a book coming out, by the way, there will be a book coming out November 1st by a very good scholar, and I have to admit I forget the name, but it's called The Secret Life of Hermes Trismegistus, and this is the whole Hermetic tradition all the way through that she's going to recount. And basically what it comes down to, the crux of it, is, as we pointed out before, that you are the center of the magical universe. And if you realize your own consciousness and realize that you are, according to the Hermetic proposition, you're the center point of your own magical universe, and you are as above, so below, and you're a miniature of the universe. This means that if you are aware of your own consciousness and you're aware of this, and you, then this means the consciousness goes on and you've got it. And then you have to assume, Hermes says you got to have piety. Well, this is what he means by that. I mean, you realize this, and you realize that everybody else has the same potential, whether or not they realize it.
One thing to have potential. It's another thing entirely to have the focus of mind and the clarity and the ability to stay focused that you can actually do anything with it. And I think that, a person can just read, you can hand a card, thou art God. They go, I'm God, great. That doesn't mean they're going to have any power as a person
That's right.
to accomplish anything. That
Absolutely.
Takes focus of mind.
Absolutely, and that's why Hermes emphasized over and over again that there are those who have the mind, and then there are those who have only the speech. They don't have the mind. The mind, you know, in the Western tradition, we emphasize the mind. In the Eastern tradition, they want to kill the mind. You know, the mind is the enemy for them. For us, the mind, following the Greek, the ancient Greek tradition, the mind is it. And Lauren just informed me that we have 40 minutes left. If you want to, if we want to continue and go over, do you feel like talking some more?
I could probably go on for a few minutes because I think there's a lot of important things to be said, especially since we're talking about the subject of death. It's appropriate to at this time, and the possibility of the survival of consciousness. I think that the Halloween Samhain time is the perfect time to have this discussion.
Good, I think you're right. And so let me say this, that I put it this way, you can respond any way you want, but when I finally came to this conclusion, and I grokked it, so to speak, this is the thing you got to grok. You can't just intellectually, you can get it. Intellectually, you can postulate it. You can come up with names for it, like romantic solipsism and all the rest of that stuff. But when you grok it, then at that point, when I finally grokked it, I suddenly realized that I didn't know anything. This is really weird. This is a weird experience. I'm not sure there's reincarnation. I'm not sure. All I know is I'm going to survive. I mean, I've got consciousness. It's going to go on. I don't know what form it's going to go on. I don't know whether I'm going to be out there on another planet or whether I'm going to be fly on a wall or what the heck I'm going to be. I don't know whether there's reincarnation. I don't know anything. And I think this is what's meant in Hermetic parlance as the pure fool at the top of the tree, as opposed to the arch fool at the bottom of the tree. You remember they switched back and
totally.
Around?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's where I'm at right now. So I don't know. So as I'm saying.
I think that's a great attitude. The I don't know is what opens so many doors. If you look at everything in front of you and every person and every experience in front of you as being a learning opportunity, you're gonna gain so much from that. As you go through life. If a person who goes through life thinking they know it all, they're closed off. They're not going to learn a darn thing.
Yeah, but here, the weird part about this is that this was the result. This thing that happened to me was the result of continual building and struggling to build this synthetic magical universe inside myself. And I kept working at it, and I kept studying more and more, thinking, oh boy, I'm just about to figure it out, and I got all these things I thought I knew about reincarnation and about past lives and about all this kind of stuff and philosophy, and then when it finally hit, when I finally got this revelation, whatever you want to call it, now I realize I don't know anything. but it isn't. You're right, though. I still want to learn. I still love to learn. But I don't know where. I don't know how long it's going to take. And how, using our system and the Western system of absorbing all these correspondences and astrologicating your life and all the rest of the stuff that we do, and acquiring this kind of late medieval perspective, all these things we do and all these mental games we play, how long does it take you to get to this point?
Well, it took you a while, didn't it?
It took me a heck of a long time. I mean, I started when I was, about 30, 35, I don't know, it's about 32, and that was 69, and 68, 69, and, when I discovered that mirror thing, And I'd had that illness and was kind of toxic and a bit weird and a bit, well, actually a bit crazy. I thought I knew everything. Boy, I really did. I thought I was the greatest wizard that ever walked. And then I began, you know, steadily to realize how much I didn't know. And then finally I got saturated, and then, you know, and then about by the time I'm about almost 70 years old, all of a sudden, you know, bang, it hits me. And part of it,
you know. So now in this progress that you've just described, somewhere in there, we were doing, and this, I don't know if you still do this ritual, but the ritual of crossing in the Egyptian boat, right, crossing to the land of the dead. Do you still do
well,
that?
So
do you still
think
that's pretty valid as a way to kind of prepare yourself for death and get ready to maintain your consciousness?
Yeah, I think so. And we did a show, by the way, you're not revealing anything that we haven't already talked about. We did a show on Kusor's boat.
Okay.
And you know, we haven't shown any pictures of it yet, but I think we probably will. We'll probably take some pictures of Kusor's boat and put it up on. Kusor's boat, by the way, recalling that show, and I think it's even in our blog, it's listed as Kusor's boat. I think you can get the archives. I think you find it. But that owes more actually to a Babylonian boat tradition, and I have to admit that the real inspiration, I think, was Abraham Merritt's Ship of Ishtar. If you recall, the ship of Ishtar was the beautiful model ship that the archaeologist got, and he kept staring at it, and finally he snapped and he was on the ship, and it was sailing on the astral, and Nergal's, the whole stern was black, and that was Nergal's cabin or temple, and then Ishtar, the whole front was, the bow of the boat was white, and her castle up there was Ishtar's castle, and they were in eternal conflict on this astral sea. And I found out that was based upon, actually Merritt, he was a very good scholar, that was based upon a Babylonian tradition. So what we did was we divided the boat down the middle, you know, our typical black and white symbolism that we used over and over again in the OTA, and of course also in Beyond Lemuria, you know, this black, the black on the left side, white on the right side. And then we have the wings folded on the boat, and it's an ibis boat.
Mm-hmm.
We even put a compass in it. And you know, on a rudder and everything. And then we put it up on the altar. And then we put the mirror up, you know. And then we put a tatwa on the mirror. And then we make ourselves very, very small. We get in the boat. And then we fly the boat through the mirror. And then we go and do that. And it wasn't, we used it to go to the land of the dead. But we also use it to fly the upper paths of the tree. Because otherwise, you know, you'd have to walk, go over a lot of ground you'd already gone over if you want to use the walking principle. So, but it's especially good. One of the boat trips is the one to Tipperet where we climb the pyramid. And then I use that symbolism I was talking about the butterflies. And so that's the boat. And I think the boat, I've used the boat a number of private rituals too. The boat is very good. Very good training for exactly that, for the soul, a soul flight. But, you know, I got to say this, that one of the things that put the final cap on my experience, Fred had told me over and over again, he said, Polk, you've got to buy Peter Kingsley's book, Reality. You have to buy that. You got to get it. And this was, you know, a couple of years before he passed on, told me that. And he said, just got to get this book. And I said, sure, Fred, I'll get it. Sure, I'll get it, Fred. Okay, I'll get it, Fred. So Fred passed on, and, you know, we sent Fred on and all of that. And I didn't get the book. And sure enough, even after I had written The Great Secret, that thing in which I expressed this only. And one of our members came and put the book down in front of me, and she said, "You should read this." And it was Reality by Peter Kingsley.
Hmm.
Yeah, and I read it. We reviewed it in the Green Ray, by the way. I read it, 600 pages, goes around in circles, and it will get you completely confused. He goes around. But then Parmenides and Empedocles would do that. And it's about Parmenides and Empedocles. Fred told me all that. But he didn't tell me what the end result was. The last 6 or 7 pages of the book are just absolute dynamite. I'm gonna evoke Fred again and say, yeah, read Peter Kingsley's Reality. It really is. It's great. Yeah, well, what do you think though about the survival of consciousness? What are your feelings on that?
Generally speaking, I figure that we haven't a clue what's going on. I totally agree with you on that. That said, my deepest take on it is that consciousness is continuous, and that we're here kind of, you know, looking at each other and feeling like that we're all separate, and that's the huge illusion. It's like the reality is that we're all like a huge mycelium, which is how this mycelium is. A mushroom comes up from mycelium, and you know the mushrooms poke up from the under the earth where the mycelium is, and the mushrooms look at each other and go, okay, here were mushrooms, and they appear to go away, but the mycelium is always there underneath and alive and connected. And I think that's like that really for us. We're all, you know, connected. And then we appear here on Earth, and we look at each other, and we feel like we're so separate. And then, you know, we die, and we never stopped really being connected. You know, we just go back to that connectedness. And I think that consciousness is just ongoing in precisely the same way that mycelium is ongoing. Mycelia are like the biggest living creation there is on Earth. A mycelium could be miles long.
You are absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, that's 150%. That's you got it. You got it. I think, you know, of course we don't know. I mean, you know, we don't know, but that's it. And that's why the remote viewers can do what they do. That's why Sheldrake's morphogenic fields work the way they do. That's why Jung's synchronicities work the way they do. That's why astrology works the way it does. This is why, you know, we are all one great mind.
And for the moment, we have the grace, the opportunity to be separate and join with each other and have fun and have love and all these great things.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. We're one great mind with all these different little attitudes that we have that are not, you know, these little attitudes are not necessarily a part of who we are. They're part of a variety, part of our variety, part of the variety of the species. But we're all together. There's no such thing as separation, and so consequently, people who feel that they are, you know, that they're important and other people aren't. It's not a very good way to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the danger, of course, in our belief and is that people, if you're going to have the idea that you possess immortal consciousness, you have to understand that if you do, everybody else does. And that means you're part of everybody. That you, if you don't understand that, then you're deluded and you're dangerous. And I really do think that. And I think we have some, you know, deluded, dangerous people who believe that they've got it and nobody else does. You know.
Yeah, yeah, but that's sort of the opposite of what really works, I think, in the long run.
Yeah. Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
And we have to. One of the reasons why, though, that this particular secret that we're talking about, this universality of consciousness, and the fact that there are those of us who realize that we have it, this is not something that the major religions or even philosophers, even psychologists. Freud was terrified of this. Freud really was. He called it the oceanic sense, and he was afraid of it. And of course Jung loved it, but this is something that the religions don't want the major religion, they don't want you speculating in this direction. They don't want you realizing this, because then of course they have no power over you.
Right. How true. I guess what one would call a vision, and it was something that came to me out of, there was nothing I was doing whatsoever that should have made me have this wonderful vision. It just kind of came to me. But it was after I had a lot of training with you with the OTA. So I think, that certainly helped. But suddenly, and it was out of a dream state, suddenly I was no longer dreaming. I was experiencing something very far beyond dreaming, and there are no words to describe what I was experiencing, and I don't think there ever could be. The only thing I can say about it was that what I experienced as my own internal being, but it was way beyond just me, was the laughter of the gods, and that was the most absolute, that was the real reality of what was going on. That was my experience. I mean, these words are so useless. But that, my experience was somehow, you could say, that the most profound thing that's going on that really is real is that this is all this phenomena that we're in the middle of is the laughter of the gods.
Yep. I think this is one of the reasons why, Tibetans do a lot of laughing. They do. Lamas laugh, and they really try. They work very, very hard at their meditation. Of course, they do. And good Lord, Kala Chakra, visualizations just make me tired just thinking about them. But they laugh a lot because they realize that. You can't take yourself too seriously, because the only thing you can really take seriously is the whole human condition, because you're part of it and you're a very small part of it, and so the whole human condition can make you sad, and it does me right now. I know you and I both were very concerned about the condition of the earth and pollution and population explosion and all these factors that make our environment and nature threaten it, and that concerns me very, very deeply. But as far as being concerned about relationships with people not getting along with each other and all that, I just wish everybody would try to get along, try to see the other person's point of view. And if they just realize that the other person really is a reflection of some part of them, and as the Buddhists say, that we're all reflections of each other.
Right.
So we try to do that. Although, on the other hand, I do think the Western perspective, and we are Westerners whether we like it or not, and our perspective, we are the engineers, we are the doers, we are the, we are the ones that are out there trying to change things and trying to make things better. And of course, so that means that the mind, that we venerate the mind, and whereas on the other hand, the Eastern perspective is the mind is something to be, something to be overcome. And our attitude is mind is something to be trained like a tool or like a dog. You get it under control and you use it.
Well, I want to just beg to differ with you a little bit on this, because the Hermetic tradition, supposedly from Hermes. I mean, didn't Hermes learn his stuff from the Eastern traditions?
That I don't think we're actually sure of, because the Hermetic tradition is earlier than Christianity. That's recently been established. Pacino's translation was from a later version of the Hermetic treatises, and it predates Christianity. But if the Hermetic tradition is of, nearly as we've been able to tell, it's an amalgam of Greek and Egyptian and Gnostic and Neoplatonic, and all of that. So how what you really have from the East is astrology, but that's filtered through the Greeks. The Greeks got their astrology from the Babylonians. The Egyptians had a magical astronomy, but they didn't have an astrology until a little bit before the time of Christ. They finally started getting an actual astrology. So astrology comes from, and that's astrology is a part of the Hermetic tradition, obviously, the bedrock of practical Hermetic philosophy. But I think we can say that Hermetic philosophy is really more Western. It's just more of a Western thing. And yet at the same time, I want to point something out that this whole Faustian idea, this whole Promethean idea, that we got to continually build stuff and we got to progress. You know, we've made a god out of progress, and got to sit back and look at progress and say, wait a minute, what's progress getting us? and is progress all that important? This is a shocker for some people when they have to imagine that. What? Yeah, sure. We live longer. The infant mortality rate is lower, and we live longer. And we live better, and we have more leisure time, and we're more comfortable. But are we happier?
Not necessarily, no.
No, we're not. And the more we progress, and the more comfortable we get, and the longer we live, and everything else, the unhappier we get. Yeah. And this is a point that Julius Evola was making. Of course, Julius Evola was not a feminist. He was anything but. But this is a point that has been made, and this is really what our Muslim friends and enemies are their position is why are you trying to force your progress on us? We don't want your progress. We want to live. If we want to live in hovels and die at 45, that's our business. We want to, But of course, you and I both, we know that we don't want them. We don't venerate their idea of persecuting women and dominating women and keeping girl children ignorant and all that and selling them like cattle. That we can't go along with. But to them, hey, we don't want progress. Take your progress and go. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that what is amusing is, or maybe instructive, is the King of Bhutan a while ago instituted their gross happiness product as opposed to their gross domestic product as being the measure of the success of their society and the programs that he had in place. And I think that's very reasonable. Because, after all, isn't that what really people want is happiness, not that the rich get richer. And certainly, I think it's become clear here, the rich have gotten richer at the expense of the middle class and the poor classes here, and people are upset about it. That's why all this Occupy Wall Street is going on and why it's hitting such a nerve for so many people. So, I think things really have gone too far in that direction here, and there's something to be said for not trying to get every last ounce of oil and every last ounce of, minerals and resources out of the earth and, adopting a simpler approach to life because, then we can live for a lot longer and be happier and not spend our time chasing dollars so much.
I thoroughly agree with you, and yet I would not call myself, I won't call myself a left-winger. I at one time I think I was a little more to the right than I'd like to remember, but I don't call myself a left winger because I believe that the American eagle should have both wings, a left wing and a right wing. Because
there you go.
if the American eagle only has one wing, he's going to fly in circles. He's so no, we need. I don't want to get political, but we
good analogy though, Pope.
We desperately need national health care. We desperately need it. I mean, you know that. I mean, it's just this health care system of ours is. And we're the, you know, the rest of the world, we're the only civilized nation in the world that doesn't have national health insurance. And it's just really, so if you want to call that left wing, all right, call it left wing. I'm not calling any names here, folks. I know, but I'm saying we need it, and we really should have it. And at the same time, though, we don't want people. We don't want the government prying into all our affairs, and we don't want them, using any of their various humanitarian excuses for invading our privacy and all of that. And that's
right.
Probably a right-wing point of view.
Well, I think a lot of people could go with that one. I certainly could.
Yeah. But Evola, Julius Evola, wrote a book. He wrote a number of books, but he wrote one called Revolt of the Modern World. Revolt Against the Modern World, he is a royalist and patriarchal and everything else, and kind of a fascist and whatever. But doggone it, he really does challenge. He challenges us to just take a look at this mania for progress. He says, why? He said people are happier if they live in a traditional culture where the traditions are venerated, where even if some people don't have the mobility that they would have in a so-called democracy, they're happier. Now, that's what he says. And you have to admit, like you're talking about, the happiness index. You have to admit he's right. And even though,
tell me the name of his book again.
It's called Revolt Against the Modern World. Joe, I don't think you're going to like it, even though you might get some good ideas out of it. But I don't think you're going to like it because this guy is really, he thinks, you know, he would take the vote away from women if he tried. You know, he was a friend of Mussolini's and all
dear
that.
Heaven.
But yeah, but no,
he
no,
also
you're
wrote.
Like,
he can't be. There can't be two guys with that name. He also wrote Introduction to Magic, Hermetic Tradition, The Symbols and Teachings of, and The Metaphysics of Sex. I see those are all books that we have in the Fairfaria Library.
Oh,
you see.
Yeah. Oh, he's no. Evola, if you can hold your nose and grit your teeth, you can learn a lot from Evola. And I'm not saying I don't buy him, you know, his stuff anymore. You know, he's a. He's a little less than Ungern Sternberg, let me put it that way, but a little less of a menace than Ungern Sternberg. But the same, you know, this royalist, this let's go back to the Middle Ages kind of where we had kings and they had absolute power, you know, and no, we don't want to do that. But still, it does let you look at, you know, you look at it, and I wish so much that we could somehow get back to handmade shoes and handmade clothes and handmade things where we could put people to work doing what they love to do.
Mm-hmm.
Where we make handicrafts. That's why I love the Ren Fair, you know, and I love these. Anyway, we could all have. That was one of the great things about the hippie movement is all the handmade stuff that we had, you know, the handcrafted sandals and the tie-dyed shirts and all the stuff that was being produced, you know, by people who were making loving crafts and trying to make a living at it.
Sure.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could do that?
Yeah, I like it. It's a great idea.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
In Bali, one of the attractions, people spend so much money to travel around the world and go to indigenous cultures, and then what they want to see there is these intact cultures where people actually make things, where they have time for each other, where they create culture, where they, you know, have traditions that go from, you know, grandparent to grandchild and so on within the community. And then, of course, you know, what we're doing is all of our kids go away as soon as they're 20 years old or 18 to go to college and don't come back. And there's no consensus of ongoing community. You know, we don't have that that oral tradition, and even if we weren't getting all of our goods from far away, our culture is being broken down every single generation by kids going away as they leave their family home, and the community has become so expensive. The community I live in, for instance, the people, like, no kid can afford to live in the community they grew up here because the prices are so high for the houses.
Yeah.
I mean, these are
the
prices that we pay for progress, which is that we don't have these things that we travel around the world to see in other cultures that we think are so wonderful, like the beauties of the handmade things in Bali, for instance, and all these cultures that we go to see.
Yeah. Well, culture. Now, you know, I spent 7 years studying culture, and I guess I learned a few things from it, I hope. But anyway, culture is such a factor. Culture is one of the major things that makes us human. And anybody, that's one of the things that I really, really dislike about both the Illuminati and the Bolsheviks, is that they tore into culture. They wanted to destroy culture. Now, granted, a lot of culture they wanted to destroy was bad and deserved to be changed. But
illuminate me here. How did the Illuminati want to destroy culture?
Adam Weishaupt was an atheist, and Adam Weishaupt wanted to use the infiltrated masonry with this thing. The idea was that they wanted to destroy the power of the churches and all the nobility, and it was completely based on Rousseau and Helvetius. You know, it was ruthless egalitarianism, and culture was in the way. So any kind of cultural institution, they were going to tear it down. And of course, he finally, with the Masons that he got to help him infiltrate Masonry, when they realized what an atheist he really was and how anti-cultural he really was, then they turned against him and the whole thing got suppressed. And, of course, fortunately, George Washington wouldn't let him in the United States. Jefferson liked him, but they wouldn't, so we didn't get him over here. But they eventually metamorphosized into the Bolshevik party that took over Russia. And, of course, when the Bolsheviks took over Russia, they attacked every cultural institution in Russia and tore it down. And granted, there was a lot of things that needed to be changed in Russia, including the Romanovs, 300 of them that ran the whole country, and sure, they needed to be overturned and all that. But you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Culture is so important to people's security, their happiness, their well-being, their sense of identity. Right, their sense of identity. But then on the other hand, culture can atrophy, and it can become your enemy. But regardless of whether it's your friend or your enemy, it's very, very, very important. So, we got off the subject of Halloween here, but I think we certainly had a stimulating discussion anyway. So, we're just about out of time, what do we got scheduled for next week? What are we looking at? Oh, yeah, we got Mike Downs next week. And Mike is one of our associate members who really, really, really gotten into the program, and Mike has been doing seasonals. So Mike is going to be on, and we're going to discuss his seasonal rights and what he's doing, and he's over in Georgia. So next week we'll be going to Georgia and we'll be finding out how the Georgia Crackers do it down here and how they're doing OTA stuff. And so next week, Mike Downs, and meanwhile, have a happy Halloween, and I'll see some of you at Rivendell. And thanks, Joe. Thanks so much for calling in. That was really, really good, and really, really some great insights. And so we'll do it again. Okay. And meanwhile, good magic.